Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Alec Nevila Lee, and we're talking about his book, Astounding, John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction. Alec, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
What inspired you to write this book? This is a monumental history, I want to mention. You really have done a lot of research, and you must have worked on this. You must have worked on this for years.
It was a multi-year project. I would say about 3 years all told. But I was lucky. I mean, I felt incredibly grateful that I had the chance to tell this story, because there really isn't like another book about this period in science fiction written for like a larger readership. And especially, the main character, the main focus of the book is a man named John W. Campbell.
Yeah.
I basically was drawn to the idea of this book because I realized that there had never been a really good biography of Campbell, which really astonishes me. You know, it's the kind of book that you think would have been written decades ago, because Campbell was the editor of the magazine best known as Astounding Science Fiction, and an incredibly influential figure, in terms of making science fiction what it is today. With a really, complex personal life, really interesting personality, hugely important, a lot of great stories. So it just seemed like a really obvious subject for a big book like this. And I'm just really thankful I had the chance to write it.
It's interesting because I'm an older person. I grew up with the early years of analog, but my older brothers had Astounding. We're reading Astounding and other magazines like that. But I remember reading... There was always these references after Campbell died to Campbell in analog, like the Campbell idea of this and that, or the Campbell style. And, you never had a clear idea about who Joseph Campbell, John Campbell was. And you'd actually say he deserves to be seen as one of the key cultural figures of the 20th century.
I think so. What the book's really about, Campbell is kind of like the central, through line, around which the book is structured. But the book is really about how science fiction became what it is now. And if you think of science fiction as being a central part of mainstream culture, which I think, clearly is, Campbell's a huge part of that story.
That's
because,
right.
The story really starts in like the mid to late 30s. When science fiction is really a subculture, it's a tiny part of the pulp magazine genre, and through Campbell, through writers like Heinlein and Asimov, it kind of moves to the center of the mainstream, and the book is really trying to kind of tell the story of how that happened as refracted through the lives of some of these writers.
One of the things he did is he made science fiction more closely aligned to science. There was a seriousness to Campbell in the way that he looked at science fiction that wasn't there before.
Yeah, Campbell, I could talk for hours about Campbell's personality, but, one of the key things to realize about him is that, he was, trained as a scientist. He went to
That's
MIT
right.
and Duke. He was kind of an aspiring inventor. He had a lot of interest in physics and in engineering, and he really carried that over to his work as an editor for Astounding. And so in his editorship, you really see an interest in science for its own sake, a real effort to write stories that were scientifically accurate and plausible, at least. That was a big part of his program. His idea was that science fiction wasn't just a form of escapism or entertainment. It was a way to work out ideas.
That's right.
In fictional form. It was like a laboratory for generating ideas about technology and about the future. So, he took that role very seriously. And, you can really see how that influenced the way people talk about science fiction even now.
Your book opens much later in 1963 with Isaac Asimov's essay called The Sword of Achilles. Why is that essay so important?
Well, I've always loved the essay, and so I'll just like a very short version of that piece. So Asimov attended a conference on education and the sciences and in the early 60s. And a lot of scientists and educators were there. And the question was, how do you find the innovators of tomorrow?
Yeah.
How do you find young people, students especially, who have the potential, to do interesting work in the sciences, and then give them the resources they need, at an early age. It can actually make a difference. Because you can't really do that for everyone. So how do you kind of single out people who might go on to do, the kind of work in the future? And Asimov had, I think, a fascinating idea, which was look for, younger students with an interest in good science fiction.
I know.
A 12-year-old kid in 1963 who is reading Analog or is reading science fiction, that's an indication that, this person might have an aptitude for the sciences. And I think that's actually a really great insight, because I can point to, my own experience and, people I know personally whose lives were changed by encounters with science fiction at that point in their lives. And I think it really testifies to the power that science fiction has, not just over, the entire culture as a whole, but on individuals, on, encouraging people to enter the sciences and take, those ideas very seriously.
It's amazing reading this book, because although the focus is on three of the major writers that were associated with Campbell, L. Ron Hubbard, Isaac Asimov, and Robert Heinlein, there's just this whole other list of other writers, and we'll talk about them probably as we go along. And it's amazing. That was the reading list of my youth. All those people were writing books that, as a young person, say around 11 or 12, that I found really, really interesting. And then when I went to the library, that's the stuff I wanted to read. And it's amazing the number of the names that go in and out of this story. It literally is the foundation. It was the golden age of science fiction.
Well, again, I think I was lucky, it was a good idea to pick Campbell as the
center. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he just intersected so many people. I mean, he is not as famous as many of the writers he worked with.
But he did write a really important book.
Yes. Are you referring to Who Goes There, I assume?
Oh, yeah. And I consider that one of the classics of science fiction. And
I should mention this. So the one thing I should say about Campbell, for people that aren't as familiar with his name, is that when he was just 27 years old, he wrote a novella called Who Goes There. So he kind of began as a writer, right? And in his 20s, he was already one of the leading writers of science fiction at that time. And Who Goes There, most famously has been adapted three times for the movies as The Thing. So if you're a fan of John Carpenter's 1982 yep. horror movie, The Thing, I mean, that's Campbell's story. It really reflects his talent. And honestly, what's interesting is that he wrote that story and then he, essentially retired from being a writer. He became an editor instead, because he saw that as being sort of a position where he could influence hundreds of writers, and have even greater power than he would as a writer. But he clearly was at the top of the field even at that point, when he stopped writing for himself.
Yeah, each of these people, including Campbell, were so different. Let's start talking about Campbell. He had a really bizarre childhood, and you write that he had no visual memory, no memories of his childhood initially.
He says this. He says that he has trouble picturing things. Right. So one thing about Campbell that I like to underline is that this is a guy who is in some ways, very much interested in the hard sciences, like physics and that sort of thing. But he's also really fascinated by psychology, okay, in the human mind. I think a lot of his experiences growing up and kind of his psychological issues, you might say, influenced the way he approached those subjects within science fiction. So he's one of the first editors to say, science fiction isn't just about spaceships. Society. It's about psychology. It's about ethics. All these things, which he really, made a deliberate effort to incorporate into the stories he published. And you can see sort of the origins of that in, what I think was really a fairly complicated childhood.
Now, you mentioned that he went to MIT, and one of his most significant influences was there, Norbert Wiener. Talk about that, because that makes total sense to me when I read that.
Yeah, so Norbert Wiener is, best known as the founder of cybernetics. All right, which is sort of this theory of control and human minds and machines, which became, incredibly influential later on, obviously. And he was Campbell's teacher. They knew each other there. Campbell says that Wiener helped him with stories. And Campbell, remained interested in cybernetics, for a long time. And, one of the things that this book tries to get at is that that interest in cybernetics you know, which, you know, is a legitimate field, right, of scientific inquiry, also influenced his work with Hubbard, which, you know, was kind of his attempt to, you know, in some ways turn cybernetics into a practical kind of mental engineering, you know, that eventually kind of became most infamous in the form of Scientology. So, you know, this is like a very interesting thread in Campbell's story where you have these influences that are right in the mainstream of sort of scientific progress, while, you know, they kind of become distorted or modified into, you know, fringe science or to much less reputable, you know, kinds of investigation.
Well, at Duke University, he was influenced by Joseph B. Rhine, who was one of the early scientific investigators into ESP.
Yes. So
and know, I find Rhine that sort of an that sort of to me was an interesting juxtaposition between Norbert Wiener and Joseph Rhine. It's sort of
Well, that sums it up.
Yeah,
that really encapsulates something about Campbell. So Rhine is, you know, most famous for, you know, those experiments with Zener cards where you know try to guess what pattern is being held up in front of you, you know, and see if you can guess it, you know, like more often than random chance would predict. You know, and Campbell believed it. You know, he was interested in ESP and telepathy, you know, from very early on. And you know, those interests, you know, as I said before, they kind of exist side by side with, you know, what we think of now as kind of the more Campbellian hard science aspect of science fiction. That mystical, you know, side is there from the very start.
Like I said, these four characters are so different. We talked about L. Ron Hubbard, and as you mentioned, most people associate him with Scientology and don't understand that early on he had a long career writing science fiction. But he also seems to be the toughest person to pin down about whether stuff actually happened or not, because he's always telling fantastic stories about his experiences. And when following him throughout your book was just, I kept finding myself, did this really happen? Or what is he, making it up or not? Yeah.
Hubbard was a real fabulist. You know, he absolutely was sort of this inventor of himself. And you know, that's a pattern that you see not just in him, but in a lot of other science fiction writers. You know, certain personalities are drawn to science fiction. You know, I think Campbell, you know, is kind of the same, you know, he's kind of, you know, falls in the same category of people where you can't always take what they say about themselves at face value. So, you know, one of the challenges in writing this kind of book is, you know, science fiction is full of these stories, these anecdotal, apocryphal anecdotes about, you know, who did what, or, you know, these myths, right, that kind of passed around and circulate within fandom and, you know, kind of orally over time. And it's very hard to kind of go back to the sources and figure out, okay, so how did it actually happen?
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Alec Neville Lee. And we're talking about his book. It's a monumental history. It's really great to read. Astounding. John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction. Asimov is interesting, too, because he seems from the get-go he was sort of a very serious guy. He was born in Russia. How did he get to America? What age?
He was three, I believe, when his parents emigrated. And they just sort of, you know, saw America as a you know, good place to go. You know, this was after the revolution, and they brought their family along. So Asimov was born in Russia, but he grew up in Brooklyn. And you know, sort of his personality was definitely shaped by his parents and kind of you know, the background that he came from.
What about Robert Heinlein? When I think of my youth in reading science fiction books, I think I read more Robert Heinlein books than anybody else that's in your book.
Well, I mean, I think that's great because I do think that Heinlein is probably my favorite science fiction writer, and he played a huge role in what we call the Golden Age of science fiction. You know, so Campbell is kind of like the central figure here, but he obviously depends on writers. He depends on, you know, talent that kind of shows up at the right time. And Heinlein is the ultimate example of that because, you know, he kind of arrives, he sent in his first story to Campbell when he's in his early 30s, you know, it's his first submission of any kind. Campbell buys it, and they struck this collaboration, which, you know, really peaks during the next, like, 3 or 4 years, but results in, like, stories that basically define what science fiction is going to be, at least, you know, like, for the next few decades.
Look at the novels. Troopers, Strangers in a Strange Land, and The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, and the list goes on.
And those are, you know, I mean, and that's actually post-Campbell, right? Timeline does, you know, some really interesting stories called The Future History, you know, like with Campbell that came out.
Well, that became his passion, is that he wanted to write future history like Asimov did.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the idea there is that, you know, we're going to write stories that, you know, could appear in like a mainstream magazine 100 years from now. So they read as if they have been published, you know, in the Saturday Evening Post or you know, like like a magazine for you know, general readers, because, you know, we're not going to like overload the reader with like backstory and technology. We're just going to present this world and have it, you know, unfold naturally, you know, over the course of telling a story, you know, and Heinlein was one of the first people to kind of really get that, which I think, you know, it puts him head and shoulders above any other writer from that period in terms of, you know, being able to convincingly get across stories about the future, about, you know, like different possible societies in a way that seemed natural.
Now, getting back to Campbell, he started writing, I think it was for Amazing Stories, when he was 19. And eventually he becomes editor of Astounding, and then which became then Astounding Science Fiction. How did he become editor of Astounding?
Honestly, it was good timing. So Campbell was, at that point, already a pretty well-regarded author, as I mentioned, you know, both under his own name and also in a series of stories he wrote under the pen name Don A. Stewart. You know, these are stories like Twilight and, you know, later Who Goes There, you know, that really are very atmospheric, you know, like very sophisticated stories that, you know, I think were recognized as being very good. You know, at that time, he wasn't really looking for a job in publishing. He was looking at other, you know, engineering jobs or technical jobs. And he just happens to be, you know, fairly close with F. Orland Tremain, who was the editor of Astounding at the time. And Tremain kind of gets kicked upstairs. He gets promoted. And he just needs someone to step in and run the magazine. And Campbell is there. He's available. He's popular with readers. So he kind of just gets the job, you know, almost out of the blue. It's one of those, like, moments, those, like, chance moments without which, you know, the history of science fiction would have been totally different.
Now, if people are having really romantic ideas about what it was like to be an editor of Astounding at that time, describe what the offices were like.
It's funny because you know, I was thinking about this. You know, you have this magazine that is publishing these like grand, expensive, stories about space and, you know, these galactic empires, and they're passing through, you know, this office that has like, you know, one desk or two desks and a couple of chairs. You know, that Campbell, you know, shares with his assistant editor, you know, Kay Tarrant. You know, it's like this little room at the back of a warehouse full of giant rolls of pulp paper, you know, and it's crammed and cluttered, and you know, like, these guys weren't rich, you know, they were just trying to get a magazine out, you know, on schedule, and you know, the contrast between like the very mundane surroundings and kind of like the scope of the ideas they were exploring has always been like really intriguing to me.
Now, there are all sorts of interesting organizations that sort of crop up in the story as you go along. Who are the Futurians in, like, the Science Fiction League?
So one of the parallel threads in this book is the rise of fan culture, which was one of the most interesting things to explore, because in some ways it's very similar to fan culture today. You know, you look at kind of the dynamics you see online, on Twitter, on Reddit, and, you know, you see the same exact behaviors in the 30s, except, you know, they're unfolding in these mimeographed fanzines and in letters columns, you know, over the course of months, you know, as opposed to over, you know, like a day or two online. But, you know, like, so the Futurians and, you know, what later became known as the New Fandom were kind of the two big factions of fandom in the New York area. All right. And the Futurians were kind of the scruffier countercultural side. You know, these were kind of real outsiders who just love science fiction, but, you know, maybe lacked social skills in other ways. And they're all poor, you know, like a very interesting kind of like fringe movement. Whereas New Fandom was kind of a bit more like the organized fan culture where you're going to put on conventions and, you know, try to cultivate connections to the professionals. There's this very interesting tension between these two groups, and it actually culminates in this like famous standoff at the first World Science Fiction Convention in 1939. You know, there's this kind of like dispute there, and some people are banished from the convention. And you know, and decades later, you know, it's still talked about, you know, as the Great Exclusion Act. You know, and you know, honestly, who knows like what actually happened. It's kind of unclear. There are different accounts of it. But the key point here is that there's this mythology of a fandom that's being developed.
That's right.
Where you have these competing groups that have their own ideas of what science fiction should be. It's still true today, right? But it was there right from the start, and that kind of conversation or debate over what the genre should represent, it's right there from the very beginning.
I love reading about that first Worldcon on July 2nd, 1939. The people in the audience included Forrest J. Ackerman and Ray Bradbury, who came to go for it. And the speakers were people like Jack Williamson, L. Sprague de Camp, Campbell, and stuff like that. What an amazing sort of just like the first kind of grouping meeting like this, and it sounded like it was a hit to the beginning.
The thing with Bradbury is that number one, he's not really a part of the story because he's based in Los Angeles, and
that's
so
right.
He's not really a Campbell writer. But he was a fan first. You know, that to me is fascinating. That Bradbury and Asimov, these are writers who are kind of the first generation of writers to grow up reading science fiction in the cult. And so it's kind of like they're prepared to carry it forward in ways that, wouldn't have been true 10 years earlier. Because kind of, as we talked about, the stuff you read when you're 12 years old, like, really shapes you forever. You know, this is the generation that was shaped, fundamentally by science fiction, and then kind of went on to, kind of take the genre to the next level.
We're going to run out of time, and we've just started the story. I want to talk about Asimov writing about robots. Mm-hmm. Early on, he wrote a story called Robbie. Mm-hmm. How did he eventually arrive at the three laws of robotics?
This is a great question. Okay, so Asimov starts to write about robots mostly because he doesn't like Campbell's attitude towards aliens. Whenever an alien would show up in a story, Campbell would always insist that the human character had to be better or smarter than the alien in some way, which really limited the kind of stories that he could tell. So Asimov said, okay, I'll just write about robots, which will avoid the whole human-alien problem entirely. So he writes a series of robot stories. And it's actually, so one thing I should say about Asimov is that he and Campbell were very close. Asimov is essentially Campbell's protege. And they would meet once a month in New York. Asimov would take the train up from Brooklyn, and they would just like talk, and talk about story ideas and just kind of go back and forth. One day they're talking about one of Asimov's robot stories, and Campbell essentially says, well, we'll see here, the robots, need to behave in this way. And he lays out, the famous three laws of robotics.
I know.
he tells them essentially to Asimov in his office. And later he says that these laws were implicit in Asimov's earlier stories. But, that's not really true. You go back and you kind of see a version of the first law, but, laws two and three, this is really Campbell kind of telling Asimov, this is how the series is going to work from now on. And obviously, like, those three laws, ended up having a huge amount of influence on AI, on robotics in general, and they came out of, just this one day or one conversation at the Astounding offices.
And also, the other part of Asimov's huge contribution foundation, the Foundation Trilogy, is him in a discussion with Campbell saying he wanted to write future history, and the Foundation series came out of that.
Yeah, and one thing I should say is that the Foundation series it doesn't always hold up as fiction, but the central idea is really powerful, which is the idea of psychohistory, which is the idea that you can create almost a science of prediction that can foresee events for even centuries in the future. And again, this is basically a Campbell idea. This is an idea that Campbell had been exploring with other writers, including Jack Williamson and De Camp. Long before Asimov came to him with the basic idea for Foundation. So, again, it's like this: the interaction, the sort of the symbiotic, interplay between Campbell and Asimov, really fascinating, and really produced like some of the most enduring ideas from science fiction.
And Campbell, we're talking about Campbell and stories about how the protagonist would face off with an alien. He wanted to come up with a new kind of protagonist. He talked about the competent man. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so Campbell had an agenda, right? I think from day one, he had this idea about how science fiction would actually change the lives of its readers. And one of the expressions of this is, you know, he kind of takes the stock pulp hero, right, sort of the square-jawed space captain hero that you see in, like, some of the earlier pulps. And he says, okay, we're going to refine this a little bit. All right, the hero is not just going to be, you know, kind of this physical specimen. He's going to be an engineer. He's going to be someone who is confronted by problems in the story, and then he solves them through the tools of science and engineering. You know, and it's called the Competent Man, right, because he's supposed to kind of have all of these intellectual attributes on top of, you know, sort of the stock physical attributes that he would have had in earlier stories. And, you know, it was a big part of Campbell's philosophy that, you know, most problems could be solved through engineering, you know, not just sort of the obvious ones, like, you know, how to fix your spaceship, which, you know, is a plot point that you see in a lot of early stories, but even how do you talk about the brain? You know, how do you talk about human behavior? How do you talk about ethics? And, you know, so the Competent Man is kind of Campbell's instrument for exploring some of these questions. And one of the sort of themes of my book is sometimes there are problems that can't be addressed this way. And sometimes Campbell had a way of simplifying things or overlooking complications because he really wanted to reduce everything to a subset of engineering.
We are completely out of time, Alec, and we've, again, just barely started to talk about this history. My guest tonight has been writer Alec Nevila Lee, and we've been talking about his monumental history, Astounding, John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction. Alec, thanks for writing a wonderful book.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.